everybody. Welcome back, and thanks for tuning in once again to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Hallengren from Sweden, and today we're talking with William Lin about occult ether physics and Tesla's hidden space propulsion system and the conspiracy to conceal it. According to the bio on his website, he had a top-secret clearance in Air Force Intelligence, earned a Bachelor's of Science degree in Art and Industrial Technology from Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas. He acquired a Master's of Fine Arts from the University of Texas at Austin, and in 1975, he says he rejected a high-paying and prestigious executive CIA position offered by then-director George Bush because he believes the National Security Act of 1947 is an illegal betrayal of American sovereignty and liberty, and that the flying saucer as man's greatest invention should be enjoyed by all. William Lin, welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for coming on. It's a pleasure to speak to you. How's everything in your neck of the woods, William?
It's quiet, and the weather's nice for a change.
That's great. That's really nice. Now, tell us a little bit about your background in this field and some of the topics we're going to get into here today. It's you've written extensively on this. Of course, you have four books now, I believe, out on this. Maybe it's more occult ether physics, space aliens from the Pentagon, and also Pentagon aliens. And now the latest one here that we're going to talk about more is occult science dictatorship. So what's your path like, William?
Early in life, I was inclined towards art and aircraft. That's when I was 3 years old. And as a child, I was basically a mechanical genius. I'm not bragging, it's just one of those things. I could take apart a watch and put it all back together and make it work if it was broken, that type of thing, when I was 3 years old. But when I was 7 years old, or 8 years old, I began to hear about the flying discs. So everything that I'd already learned about airplanes, which involved aerodynamics and so forth, was thrown out the window when I heard about these things. Not completely at first, until I witnessed one of these ships when I was 15. But when I was 8, I began to interview oil field pumpers who witnessed these things in southern New Mexico, and they'd been seen in West Texas, and which I assumed were German aircraft that were brought over here after the war. And I heard from a friend of mine who'd grown up where Tesla did his experiments in Colorado Springs, and he was a Tesla aficionado, so to speak. It was a radio man, and he told me that those were flying machines invented by Nikola Tesla, and that was in 1946. In 1947, of course, you had the Roswell incident, and so that excited my interest, and I began to watch the skies a lot more. I saw whole squadrons of UFOs flying from New Mexico into West Texas at night, whole squadrons of them at high altitude. And then they would turn in increments of 30 degrees, 90, 60, 180. They could reverse course at high speed. So I thought, well, these are really interesting, you know. And so I was also an artist from the time I was a small child. And eventually I studied. In 1953, I saw, we had an incredible sighting when we were having a party in our backyard. And one of these ships appeared, and I basically clocked it at 36,000 miles per hour when it left in 3 seconds. It took 3 seconds to reach a point of infinity. It did 290-degree turns and then went to infinity in 3 seconds. And in West Texas, that would be 36,000 miles an hour. I calculated that on 30 miles to the point of infinity, plus my eyesight was at least 20/20. So, and I counted off the seconds as it departed to clock it, because I'd learned to do that. I'd been clocking aircraft quite a while, and I was interested in, you know, aircraft performance and speed and that sort of thing, and I had been building model UFOs, flying saucers, with propellers on them and one with a jet engine. And when I saw that, I realized that all that, the propellers and jet engines, had nothing to do with it. It was absolutely, had nothing to do with aerodynamics, because there was no sonic boom and there was no shock wave or any of that stuff. It didn't make any noise. There was no swishing around or anything. It was just silent. And the electrostatic discharges were profuse. So I decided at that point that it was an electrical flying machine.
How did you detect or measure the electromagnetic discharge?
Just by sight, you could see the corona was pretty incredible around it. It left a trail of corona behind it that sparkled and then scintillated and then eventually faded out.
Right.
And that meant there were electrostatic charges in the air. And also, as a thing, when we first spotted it, it was precessing at about 45 degrees as it hovered, which was only about 300 feet away. And it was at about 45 degrees at about 300 feet from our position. And so as it precessed on the bottom, it had a red glow, a pinkish glow. That usually means microwaves, but the rest of it was electrostatic. So it had the pinkish glow indicated, some sort of electromagnetic field.
Right.
Make it glow that color, infrared. And the electrostatic discharges were profuse, so you couldn't miss them. And it created a rainbow effect, what they call metallic color. You see red. That's the reason people are so confused about the color. You know, they see red, blue, green, pink, violet, all of the colors appear in this corona. And so anyway, that. I went ahead and I was in the Air Force. I was in Air Force Intelligence for a short time, and I was put in there because I had uncovered what basically had happened. I uncovered a Soviet spy ring, which is running the Air Force Career Counseling Center at Lackland Air Force Base, and they were sabotaging personnel records, putting people in, juggling their aptitude scores, putting them in the wrong fields. And I uncovered that, and then, so what happened was the Air Force apparently didn't appreciate that. Eisenhower didn't like it. They poisoned me. They tried to murder me, and I didn't die, but I was left with narcolepsy. So I was still, represented, something that had to be taken care of by damage control. So they stuck me in Air Force Intelligence to try to shut me up and keep me from talking about this.
Why was that, do you think? Do you think there would be, happy.
I think Eisenhower thought he'd lose the election if the public found out. It was right before the election in 1956, and he was afraid he'd lose the election if the public found out. That's my only thing I can come up with, that they would do something like that, to somebody for uncovering something that important, because, it was something that would have been on the headlines, if news media had gotten hold of it.
Let me ask you, did they... Although it was remained quiet, it seems like, in the press and such, did they still kind of dissolve this spy ring unofficially, or what happened?
I was told the Air Force intelligence people weren't involved in persecuting me. They were trying to help me. So that means they knew I was getting screwed, so to speak,
right?
And were trying to help me because they thought that I was kind of like, to them, I was kind of like a hero who was getting really, really getting screwed. So they told me that this ring had been arrested, and that was the only reason I knew about that, my tip about this to the adjutant, because they'd screwed my test scores up and put me in the wrong field. So the only reason I knew about that ring was because Air Force Intelligence contacted me and told me they'd been arrested and they would try to help me. But I made the mistake of telling my roommate that. My roommate was the little brother of the Navy officer who was in charge of putting me down. And all that information went to him, so the Air Force intelligence guys were probably reprimanded, or who knows what happened to them, over that, because they weren't supposed to, it was confidential. So anyway, after I got out of I studied art. I began to study art at night when I was in the Air Force. I went to art school in Columbus, Ohio for a year and a half, and then I went back to Texas and I studied art in college. And eventually I went to undergraduate school at Sam Houston State University, and I majored in fine arts and minored in industrial arts. Actually, it was a double major. And so I learned quite a lot about technology in the industrial arts minor or major. And then I went to the University of Texas and got a MFA in studio arts. And So then I came to New Mexico about 44 years ago.
Hmm.
So it was 44 years ago I came to New Mexico, and I've been here, and there's been quite a lot of activity of UFOs in New Mexico. We used to spot them, but they're harder to see now because I think they're clamping down on sightings. They don't want people to see them much now, so they're being very secretive right now.
Huh. Interesting.
Just since Obama's been in office, they've been very secretive.
Right. Well, we'll need to talk about that more later as well, William. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Please carry on there.
Sure. And so that brings us up to the present, and I've written these books since 1993. I also do some inventing, and I have an invention called the Lion Atomic Hydrogen Furnace, and it is scheduled to be built and tested. So that is something that I'm looking forward to because it's a very interesting technology. And it may be very upsetting to the oil industry, I think, in the end.
All right.
Unless they figure out some way to crush it, you know, or whatever. But it has promise. There's been a number of copycats. I published a primitive set of plans in one of my books in 1997. And it's been copied by a number of people. And they've tested it, so there's a number of tests that show that it's very promising. Just as I'd said in the original book, even without the testing. So I predicted it to be very, very good for producing energy from the environment.
Well, I definitely want to ask you more about that later on as well, but let's go back a little bit here and talk about some of the things, you know, then that you've written about and such, in specifically related to, well, both Tesla's work and also the UFO field in general. I mean, you have a unique, we could call it, you know, view or approach or interpretation to this particular work. Tell us more about, you know, what you call the electrodynamic space propulsion and how you, you know, went about, I guess, realizing or decoding, you know, Tesla's work, basically.
Well, it was like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. I'd find a piece here and a piece there, you know, and it took quite a while to put it all together. And then I realized it's not electromagnetic or electrodynamic space propulsion. It's actually electrostatic. It's electromechanical is a better way to describe it. It actually uses what Tesla called mechanical waves. And these are created with the Tesla coil. A Tesla coil is an electrostatic generator. And it produces DC, rapidly varying electrostatic voltages. And they vary very rapidly. It's the rapid variance of the voltage that creates these waves in the ether, which Tesla calls sound waves in the ether, which travel at the speed of light. And what that means is according to Tesla, is electromagnetic waves can't travel in free space. They can only travel through solid substances, and that's the reason for the difference between Einstein, Hertz, and all these other people, is they believed in a solid ether, and Tesla believed in a gaseous ether. And because only a solid ether could actually conduct electromagnetic waves. So these are actually what we call radio waves, are actually mechanical longitudinal pressure waves in the ether that travel at the speed of light. They're similar to sound waves, which travel in the atmosphere, and except they travel at the speed of light, and they use the ether, which is subatomic. So it's a different look at this thing. And Tesla said these mechanical waves propel his ship in a pulling action. So the waves are projected in front of the ship, and it pulls the ship forward, and it's a very powerful effect, of course. And it probably reacts on the atmosphere, too, to cancel shock waves and sound waves. I mean, normal sound waves and sonic booms.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what causes a boom is the air coming back together after it parts. Same way as when a lightning bolt strikes, that boom you hear from a thunderbolt is not from the air coming apart, it's from the air clapping back together.
Right.
So this wave of, as I describe it, a trail of electrostatics behind the ship apparently keeps the air from clapping back together quickly. so it prevents the sonic boom. And so it's quite interesting that all these things work together to produce such a fantastic airship. And most people think it, think the reason people think this is alien technology is because we've been kept so far behind about the real developments in science by the government that it looks like alien technology to us because we're I don't know, 35, 40, 50 years behind the government.
Right.
So they have this fantastic technology, and it's all classified, and we're denied the use of this stuff in violation of our Constitution, which set up the patent system to transfer technology from inventors to the public. So they're not transferring that technology. It's, you know, it's supposed to be given to us after 17 years. The inventor has 17 years of exclusive use and development of his own invention, and then we get it. So we're being denied the use of fantastic technology because the oil companies and other corporations control the government, and they don't want us to have this stuff because it will ruin all their investments.
It's a lot of, you know, the power hierarchy very much kind of resides on this particular, you know, struggle, if you will. But you write in the beginning of Occult Science Dictatorship, you know, that the motive is basically began behind this idea that the establishment media, they've been promoting you know, relativism. It was to suppress and ridicule and conceal basically what you mentioned is the ether, you know, physics and other kind of free energy discoveries, and that this happens in conjunction with you know, the media giants and the energy companies, as you mentioned. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yes. Well, you see, you take, for instance, the oil industry. I grew up for 12 years. I was in West Texas as a boy. And then I worked for an oil company eventually, for a couple of years, after I was in the Air Force. And, the oil companies basically, they have all their investments in these mineral rights and, so forth. And if somebody came along with the new energy discovery, well, all that investment could be worthless very quickly. And, so the banks are backed up in it, too. They're all invested in this same type of stuff. Archaic technology is what I call it. They're invested. We're using archaic technology. The most fantastic thing we have is archaic. A jet plane is a piece of junk compared to a UFO. And same way UFOs can replace trains, trucks, you name it. There's, as Tesla said, weight is no object. So that means that a large UFO could pick up a herd of cattle and take them to a market in the matter of minutes. There's no problem with picking up those kinds of weights. I've seen UFOs that are pretty large. I saw one in Hyde Park that was about 50 feet thick, about 450 feet long, and about 250 feet wide, shaped like a big lozenge, you know, rounded all around. But it looked like had the profile of a football field, you know, that size. And it, on the bottom, it was dark green. And it was putting off the Tesla corona ahead of itself. So the corona, the discharges from the electrostatics were moving towards the front and reaching out in advance of the ship. So that's consistent with what Tesla said, the sound waves in the ether going in that direction and pulling the ship forward. So, you know, I saw one of those in the mountains above Santa Fe, a place called Hyde Park. I was in a hot tub with a group of people, and we spotted that ship, and it did a big circle in a few seconds and came back and stopped on the dime. And then my son and I saw a large ship, bigger than that, between Santa Fe and Los Alamos, one evening, just at sundown, and this ship was probably 600 feet across, and was shaped like a big saucer shape, although it wasn't rounded, it was more like angular saucer on the bottom and top, and then it had a row of lights around the middle that were sequencing counterclockwise. They were sequencing and red, so this red light thing, and they were like different banks of lights around it were lighting up and turning on and off as it went around. So I think that might be some sort of stabilization technology using infrared, because as Tesla said, and the ether physicists said, that the ether is a solid, let's see, what did they say? It's a solid to light and heat. So it would solidify the ether, this infrared light would solidify the ether and stop the precession motion, because a precession, when you think about it, is probably some kind of an ether reaction. You know, when a body precesses because it's spinning, or something spinning inside of it to make it precess.
Right.
So the actual UFOs that I've seen haven't been spinning. I've never seen one actually spinning, but it they can create the effect of spinning by precessing. It causes the light to play around on the bottom, kind of like a aluminum pan, you know, that's been spun. You know what I'm talking about? Metal spinning. It's a technique.
Yeah.
It has these little lines all in it, and when you wave it around, the light plays around on it. It kind of looks like it's spinning. So that's kind of an optical illusion, I think. But you think about it, a UFO couldn't really be spinning because it would create so much gyroscopic stability that the ship wouldn't be able to turn. It wouldn't be able to go up or down. You know, it wouldn't be able to turn down or up because of the momentum. It's like a bicycle wheel. You know, once it's spinning, you can't just turn it, you know, very rapidly. You know what I mean? It resists being turned. So it's like any spinning object. So you don't want that. But inside the ship, there is spinning machinery to generate the electrical current that is used to power the ship. And Tesla wove this in with the stabilization system. So the turbine, along with the machinery, was used to create stability on one axis, and they had probably had another axis of stabilization to create gyro stabilization of the ship to keep it, you know, steady in the sky, because, as he said, it could remain absolutely stationary. So basically they can use, you know, high definition of, you know, telescopic camera equipment to spy on people, this type of thing. You know, that's what I believe they're using it for, is surveillance. And they had trouble developing weaponry for the UFO originally when the Germans had it, because you couldn't put normal ammunition aboard a UFO, because the detonators and bullets was made out of fulminate of mercury. And if you put electrostatics around fulminate, it's going to explode. So if they put ammunition on there, the ammo would start exploding from the power system. So they didn't have any bullets to put on the ships originally. So they just used them to draw the fire of our bombers over Germany during World War II. I saw the film was made by my intelligence division during World War II, so we had the original film in our library, and it was shown to us one day, which I was kind of astounded, because that's highly classified. We actually saw the footage of the Foo Fighters attacking the B-17 bombers over Germany at night, and you could see the ship flying around and the electrical discharge, and it was not small like the misinformationists would have you believe. They were about the size, the ships that I saw were about the size of a Volkswagen. And I speculated that maybe, what's his name? What's the designer of the Volkswagen, the German designer?
Good question, actually. I should know that.
Ferdinand Porsche. They have designed the original German UFOs, you know.
So it's
well known.
Is that where you think it's come out of? I mean, you're determined, I guess, then pretty much at this point, that what we see with the UFO phenomena, this is a completely man-made, you know, thing. It's a technology from us. It's not alien. It's not, reverse engineered from some crash or something like that. So obviously I want to ask you more, both how you came to that conclusion, but also then in the extension, how was this developed? I mean, is it's something that's built on Tesla technology, but other people have picked it up consequently and expanded on it?
Well, Tesla offered it to the U.S. government in 1914. They turned him down, so he sold it all to Germany, along with a lot of other technology, including submarine technology, torpedo technology, stuff like that. And he offered it to the government, the U.S. government first, and they turned him down. So
you know why?
Well, he had to have money. He needed money. And
why the U.S. government turned it down?
Who knows? Maybe they had somebody else that in the corporate world who had a cozier deal with, and they thought, well, we don't want to spoil this arrangement with our friends here. So that's the only thing I can come up with. And so Tesla sold them that, and then that was before the war, so nobody really knew there was going to be a war, I suppose. And so then in the 1930s, the Germans were interested in this technology, and so they had a secret project at Los Alamos, New Mexico, when that was just a Spanish land-grant property there. And it was funded by the Florence and, Guggenheim Foundation. It was funded by the Guggenheim Foundation, and it was funded by the National Geographic Foundation, and it was funded by the Smithsonian Institution. And there's been nothing published about it. I'm the only one that's published anything on it. They funded this project at Los Alamos, and the Germans, Von Braun showed up with 16 top German scientists, and they worked on that project for 2 years. So Von Braun was actually in New Mexico for about 2 years before World War II.
Okay.
And he's from 36 to just before Christmas, 1938, when he went back to Germany, married his high school sweetheart. But, you know, there are people who have tried to dispute this on me. Well, they're just ignorant people. The scientists at Los Alamos know about this. I've talked to a number of them. They're familiar with it. I first heard about it from my friend Peter Van Dresser, who was the inventor of that rocket engine that Von Braun acquired in that project, took back to Germany and put on the V-2.
Mm-hmm.
And Van Dresser and his four partners in the American Rocket Society up in New York actually developed that engine. And so Von Braun was able to pick up the final, you know, product of the UFO project along with that rocket engine and by coming to Los Alamos. And, of course, that was before the war.
Tell us a bit more about that, the foundations, the Guggenheim Smithsonian there in Los Alamos with a German faction. Now, is this beyond, you know, national stuff? Did the U.S. military know about that at the time, or is this more of a private, you know, thing, if you know what I mean?
It's very strange. I seem to be the only one that's published anything on it, although I was able to, I know from my friend Peter and from his papers that are in the archives, the New Mexico archives, and things that he told me, the first scientist from Germany that was invited by the American Rocket Society to participate in this research was Willy Ley. So he came over around 1934, but he defected. And he said all he wanted to do was get away from Hitler. The Nazis had taken over the project at Peenemünde. And actually, it was at Kummersdorf first, and then they moved it to Peenemünde and made it a military project. And so Ley was able to get away from the Nazis, but the U.S. government didn't employ him in any capacity until the end of the war, even though he was the real genius in German rocketry at the time. But you see, the engine that Peter and his associates had developed was the only one that worked for sustained flight. The rest of them all blew up because the combustion chamber overheated. And what they did is they wrapped the fuel line around the combustion chamber to cool it and also vaporized the fuel and made the engine a lot more efficient. So it made it practical for outer space, and that's what they were interested in. They were just interested in exploring space. That was their main idea. Willy Ley and his these other guys. And
And the American Rocket Society, they weren't tied to the government directly, correct? Or were they funded by them?
No, they were a private group that Peter and his friends were the founders of the American Rocket Society, but then it expanded and included Dr. Robert Goddard in Massachusetts, who had laboratories in New Mexico, and he was part of that project at Los Alamos, too. And they invited Von Braun when Willy Ley had defected, so they just found a replacement for Ley, and that was Von Braun, and Von Braun was rapidly accelerated in rank just before he came because I guess they wanted to make sure that he didn't defect too. And so, you know, then they worked on this project and then they folded it all up. Apparently at the end of the project, they actually, Tesla wrote up a paper on the project and sent it to Washington, and the U.S. government shut the project down. So I thought, well, this is just really amazing, you know, that the government just ignored all this stuff. They didn't develop, the U.S. government didn't develop any significant liquid fuel rocketry during World War II. It was all solid fuel rockets. And meanwhile, the German projects had gotten quite advanced. And they had developed the UFO by that time to a higher form. Now, the project in Los Alamos during the 30s was called P2, small p, large 2. Small p, large 2, P2, mm-hmm. which has something to do with electromagnetic dipole or something like that, basically a Tesla coil. The symbol for the project was a triangle with a dot in the middle, which brings to mind some Masonic idea, you know, the all-seeing eye, you know, that sort of thing. And
so is this anything that's been documented, as you said, in the archives or whatnot, or is this more from witness and testimony from people who worked on it?
Well, I did research what I could find on Von Braun's biography along with Billy Lay's.
Right.
And I could see the missing 2 years, you know, from Germany. I could see the, the way Lay had come over and then he married a Russian ballerina named Olga Feldman. So I guess that put him on the outs with the Third Reich right there.
Hmm.
But, he stayed on, and the government eventually employed him at College Park, Maryland in a secret project of some sort, probably the first American UFO project after the war, or they were getting ready for it. I think they already knew they were going to get this project from Germany before the war was over, and they were already getting ready for it.
Well, it seems to me, if you piece this together in hindsight, then if this is how things indeed unfolded, it seems like this is really just the inception point of what was concluded with Operation Paperclip, that they began, you know, with the work over in the U.S. first, split up and then basically, carried on one branch of this in Germany. And then after the war, U.S. ships over, you know, the Nazi scientists again and kind of picks it up from that point. Is that how things unfolded then, in your view?
Yep, pretty much. Actually, there was a project before Paperclip called Project Alsos. It was run by an American of Russian extraction named Boris Pasch. And they picked up 100-something Nazi scientists who were scheduled to be executed by General Franz Kammler. And Kammler was apparently working with the Allies already. And he delivered those scientists to Portugal, where they were handed over to the American authorities, and then he certified back to the Third Reich that they were executed. So we got those scientists, and then they were from Peenemünde, and I believe that's where they were from. And then of course Von Braun took his group to link up with American intelligence too. He took his group out of Peenemünde, and it was eventually picked up very early, and Von Braun was in charge of American rocket research at Fort Bliss, Texas, for the U.S. Army in June 1945 or something like that, very early, you know. I mean, it didn't take him any time at all before he was already in charge of the rocket research. And Fort Bliss bleeds over into White Sands Missile Range. It's outside El Paso, but it also includes part of New Mexico, and then, you know, that link, that's contiguous border with White Sands Missile Range.
Right. Which
is where they did a lot of the UFO research and rocket research. And, so that whole area was just, one of the air bases there in New Mexico, let's see, what is it? It's, Holloman Air Force Base at Alamogordo was where they did early UFO flights, and those flights were coming out over West Texas quite a bit, and that was north of where we lived, and just across the Texas border. So there was information leaking out, you know, even though they don't think there were any leaks, there were. And so I was keeping a close eye on this stuff. Here was I, the boy, you know, experimenter. You know, I was, you know, I experimented with Tesla coils and that sort of thing, and was really working on this UFO project. And it took me quite a while to finally put it all together. And my books have a lot of errors in them up until just about 3 years ago when I finally began to really piece it together. You know, there was some, you know, I was playing around with different things, electromagnetic propulsion, you know, hydrodynamic, the different kinds of propulsion systems, you know, and I finally came up, realized when I reread these Tesla papers that he said it was mechanical waves, so that's, and sound waves in the ether. So that tied it down.
So you're saying you managed to replicate some of the discoveries of what consequently has been put in the UFOs that we see. Is that correct?
I wasn't able to get lift off on anything that I built, but some of the people that experimented with it did.
Any names there you want to mention from people?
I can't. There's a man who bought my second edition of Space Aliens from the Pentagon, and he read it on the airliner on his way across the country, and then he and his father did the experiments and got lift off.
Okay.
And his father was also an engineer, so they were able to get lift off. And I wasn't able to view it because I didn't have the money to travel to visit with them.
So at this point, William, has this been theoretical hypothesis from your point of view up to this point, or have you ever witnessed one of these machines or how they actually operate up close?
I haven't. You mean witnessed one that? Well, most of the people that have had, there's another person that got success, but he's driven crazy by the government, and he lives in Santa Fe. And he wouldn't tell me that he'd gotten lift off. His father told me. And the other guy just doesn't want to be identified, and I blame him. So I haven't witnessed it. I only have the word of this guy who invited me to come view the results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't afford it, so I didn't go.
Well, that's a bummer.
Was all the way up in New York, which is a long way from here. And it's pretty interesting. So I got the information that the guy, apparently, even with the old plans, which I put in a second edition of Space Aliens from Pentagon, he was able to get that result because it's just a matter of tuning. You know, it's if you, you know, have things oriented the right direction, then you can get the results. And it's basically Tesla technology.
Right. So I want to ask you more about that later, the makeup and you know, what we're actually seeing and how it potentially could be replicated and all that interesting stuff. But before we do that, how do you think that this is unfolded in terms of what they actually do with the technology? And just to be clear on another point here as well, is this something that still is tied to, let's say, national security from the point of view of, all right, this is the U.S. government, it's the military, you know, sub-branch of that actually has, you know, developed the program, it's they who are running it, or is it, I think this is an important question to kind of try to pin down a little bit more, is it a private co-joint entity of various people from different nationalities, and it's not really government or military run?
I believe there is a world government. It's been in existence since I was 19 years old. I mean, it's been in existence longer than that, but that's when I became aware of it, that it had to be a world government, because this stuff is not really handled much by the military. Very few, if anybody, in the military really is privy to this information. They keep it at a very high level, although they do constructions. These ships are being constructed on military bases because they have the security of the military. They couldn't locate this in some city, or they'd have to worry about leaks and spies and all this kind of stuff. So they put it on military bases. And their normal aircraft corporations are involved in building these things, like Raytheon and Teledyne are involved in making components. And other corporations, you know, are involved in making these ships, and they have a lot of them. And it's held at a very high level, and there are international agreements that we know about some of them, but we don't have any idea about some of these agreements because they're secret executive edicts. There was something like during Eisenhower's time, there was something like 700 edicts, secret ones.
On an international scale level?
Yeah. And that's basically how they're controlling our, you know, people are alarmed about the way the government keeps taking away our civil rights. And they can make, according to the way the filthy U.S. Supreme Court interprets the Constitution now, the government can execute a treaty that takes away all of our rights. And it becomes the law of the land.
Right.
Although that's not my interpretation of the Constitution. The Constitution says all laws passed pursuant to the Constitution, which means that the Constitution overrides anything that tries to supersede it.
Right, yeah.
However, that's these secret edicts. And they basically, for example, at the end of World War II, under the Yalta Agreement, they gave Russia a monopoly on platinum metals. And there wasn't any competition. In this country, they didn't recognize any platinum production in the whole United States. And so if anybody tried to produce platinum here, the Russians had the right to come in and take and steal the platinum or stop the production. And they actually did this. And they, for instance, the 2,200-pound ingot of platinum disappeared on a train in South Africa. It was removed from the train and probably buried, you know, along the way, just to prevent platinum construction, competition with the Russian government, which had a monopoly on platinum group metals. But there was some production in Canada and other places. But they basically, the biggest platinum production was in nickel, you know, the place in Russia called nickel, which is just totally talking about apparently it's very heavily contaminated, you know, with chemical wastes or deadly stuff and so forth.
Tell us a bit more than what this has led to and where you think they are at this stage. I mean, what are they doing with the technology? Where are they going? Are we talking about space programs that have been running now, you know, unofficial ones for a long time? And if so, any speculation as to what's going on?
Well, my idea is, I'm not certain that they're going in outer space with them, but they could be, and they probably are, because according to the theory, they could travel in outer space. And since the ether is all-pervading and everywhere, they could be traveling in outer space, and they could travel at pretty much any speed they wanted to, so they wouldn't have to use the high-speed travel of a rocket to, you know, that would be pelted with, asteroids and so forth, to go, like, to the moon or somewhere like that. But I believe there, and there's a fact, it's factually true, there have been international agreements, for instance, with Russia, since long before the end of the Soviet state. There were international, you know, agreements. So there was cooperation because they all agreed, all the major countries agreed to keep the UFO sighting secret. In 1955, they had a meeting in Switzerland, and they agreed to keep it secret. So they're not hiding it from each other. They're hiding it from us. And all the major powers have UFO technology.
You know, right, yeah.
Possessed by the United States, Canada, Sweden, Norway, Germany, probably France, probably China, and England. And so, you know, that technology is, you know, if I could figure out basically how it works, then so could any other scientist anywhere, you know, that had the freedom to do so, or the encouragement by their governments to do so. And the Iranians claim they've got it now, which could be why there's suddenly a turnaround in their attitude towards Iran.
Right, yeah, but I've heard about that too. It was actually, I think it was when we had Cash on the program who has claimed credit for the production of those that Iran has, that it was actually at that point that the other ones, well, basically he said that the other ones don't have it and Iran was the only one, but, you know, there you go. It's just going to be discrepancies like that in between people. But do you think then that this has anything to do with what allegedly was found out by, you know, quote unquote hacker, you know, Gary McKinnon looked into the NASA stuff where he talked about, you know, the Space Command, I believe it was, there was basically off-world, you know, people who were involved in a program. Is that on that level? Yeah.
Oh, I believe that's misinformation about aliens. There's no aliens coming to.
No. This was about human, like a Space Command. It was a military program run, I guess, by NASA, who had officers in space and had a program running, basically.
My son has a cute little video that he made about 6 years ago called Electromagnetic Flight and You, in which it's a fake Army training film for UFO pilots after World War II. And he called it the Gravity Corps. But they inevitably were training American pilots out of Holloman Air Force Base. And that's what we were seeing. We were seeing UFOs that were being piloted by German and American pilots. Because they brought 15,000 Germans to New Mexico after World War II. And there's no record published anywhere of that, but I got that information from a neighbor who was she was a German security agent from the time she was 15 years old, assigned to White Sands Missile Range. And she was Bavarian, and owned a castle over in Austria-Hungary somewhere that the German government bought from her even before the fall of the Soviet state. They figured they'd use it for a tourist attraction when things came back to normal. And but anyway, she was a major in the Wehrmacht, and she told me she was part of a group of 15,000 Germans. And they were signed, you know, to New Mexico. So that's quite amazing. And you know, there are only a few hundred scientists in that group, but many technicians and support personnel. And they brought that whole project over to New Mexico because they were afraid the Russians were going to overrun the whole country in Germany and grab all this stuff. So I don't know. There was all kinds of technology they were afraid that Russians were going to get. The Russians got quite a lot of it. And, but the United States already had major bits of it. And, there were three sets of files. And the United States acquired all three of the technical files. And, one of the things that was used by General Otto Skorzeny to negotiate for his amnesty was that he had stashed some of this technology, and he could turn it over to the Russians or turn it over to the Americans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to make a deal with him. And then what they did is they sent him down to the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps, sent him down to Argentina to set up Odessa. So Odessa was actually a creation of the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps to protect the SS from being extradited and interrogated by the KGB. And they didn't want the Russians to interrogate them. They knew too much. And so these guys were all sent down there. And the gold that was taken down there by Bormann was used to sustain them until eventually they started investing in various things and to sustain this group. And so they've been involved in a lot of investments.
Well, let me just talk a little bit briefly here more about the books and where people can get those, and then we can take a short break and then carry on and talk more about this. I have, you know, many more questions I want to ask you pertaining to the work, you know, in the books, and also tying this into a little bit going back again to the scientific kind of dictatorship that's kind of laid on top of it, or the occult scientific dictatorship, as the book is called, but. and the mind control aspect and everything else. So much more to get into that, William. But let's give out some of the details here. People, I guess the easiest way for people for now to get a hold of the books if they want to read more is on Amazon.com, correct?
Yes.
And give us the titles of the books that you have so people can just search for that. We're going to have some of the links up as well on the website, but give us the titles.
Well, the ones that are in print are Occult Ether Physics, and there is a third edition, but the fourth edition is available, and I suggest people get that. Why get the third when you can get the fourth? Fourth has a little bit better information. It's the last edition, and to me, it's the last edition I'm going to write of that book because I don't expect, unless I come up with, you know, miraculous information in the future, but that's as far as I can go with the information that's available. So Occult Ether Physics is available. You can get it in digital copy or hard copy. You can get it in Europe, and you can get it in Germany, France, England, Italy, Spain. I don't know which other countries. I don't remember right at this moment. And same way with Pentagon Aliens. And I don't think Pentagon Aliens is available as a digital copy. It's only a hard copy. And then you have Occult Science Dictatorship. And so there are three books, actually four if you can count the third edition, not the fourth edition, which I probably should just withdraw and make people buy the fourth edition. But so those three books are available at Amazon.
All right, very good. We're going to have some links up there. And then there is another website. It has a couple of years on it right now, but it's there for people who want to check it out. It's line4line.tripod.com, and it's the number 4 in the center of that. So LYNE, 4 LYNE .tripod.com. We're going to have the link up, so check that out. But yeah, we'll take a short break here then, William. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more and pick this up after the break.
I'm
Okay. We're just getting started here, and we'll continue in the second hour at redicemembers.com. We'll hear more about the occult scientific dictatorship, Williams's powerful economic interests, which also controls the government, the mass media, and academic institutions have used scientific thought control for sinister means. This includes the invention of scientific and metaphysical theories that lead to nowhere. William shares his experiences with UFOs, which he says are man-made. He also talks about propaganda surrounding aliens, which is all part of a plot to conceal the technology. Good stuff coming up, so keep listening. First hour, always free, sometimes both. We spare you from commercial interruptions and website ads. You can stream or download over a year of programs for free from the website redicecreations.com. Then, when you want to hear more and support the broadcast and our investigations and productions, sign up for a membership. You can catch the rest then at redicemembers.com. Subscribe, get full access. It's quick, easy, and it's only about the price of 2 cups of coffee per month. Try out a subscription. I think you will enjoy it. There is lots to learn. Our archives are vast. More coming up on Red Eyes Radio, by the way. We have Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, John King, William Mullen, Kong Pop Yuyen, Karen Hughes, and Barbara Peterson. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you after the break.